This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thanks very much for choosing to listen to this. I'm Mark Stephen. We build the Scotland Outdoors Podcast out of a live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which is called Out of Doors. And for obvious reasons, given how sunny it is, given how light it is, given how strong the birdsong is, this week we were largely concentrating on spring. I'll be absolutely honest with you, it was touch and go whether I was going to come in this morning. I mean, I was up, you know, and I was driving in, but it was just beautiful. Half moon across in the east, Venus very low on the horizon, skeins of mist. I mean, yesterday was actually pretty warm here in Aberdeenshire, you know, and it's down to about 1.5 degrees at the moment. I can see my breath in the car park here in BBC Aberdeen, but just, I really just wanted to stop the car, get out, climb a wee hill and just sit and watch it unfold. I'm Mark Stephen, I'm standing in the car park in Aberdeen, 40 miles to the north, Mr. Ewan McElroy.
Yeah, I came out the door this morning and just stood and let the sun's rays soak up. You know, it is just, you know, it's like coming out of a sleeping bag. Suddenly you emerge into the spring and it is just wonderful. And we are talking about spring this morning. What's your favourite sights, your smells? Is it the daffodils? Is it the snowdrops? Get in touch, tell us. Outofdoors at bbc.co.uk.
You know, it's questionable whether this is actually spring or whether this is false spring, because it could go back to snow next week. We just don't know. But anyway, we're going to be chatting live to author Jim Crumley about spring. I visit Loch Leven National Nature Reserve to see the work that started on the new hide.
Yeah, I think there is snow coming, but it doesn't matter because you know the good times are ahead. You're not going back to darkness, and it makes such a difference broadcasting in daylight. We also have the mystery bird. Now, we thought this was too easy, so we're trying to make it difficult, but I still think it's going to be easy. Have a listen.
There you go.
See, I was working on a boat off around during the last week, and it was three or four folk came and said, what's a mystery bird this week?
Here's a packet of sausages. There's plenty more where that came from.
Well, it was the same down in Stow when we were there. You know, tell us what the mystery bird is. Give Quentin a call. 08 085 92 95 00.
I have to confess that, you know, I'm endlessly curious about the natural world and everything around me, but the world of algae is one that I really don't know that much about. But at the Scottish Association for Marine Science near Oban, they've been collecting and studying algae for a couple of hundred years.
Yeah, next month they're opening an expanded facility which will see them take centre stage in worldwide research. Dr. Michael Ross is the manager of the culture collection of algae and protozoa. And what a great title. I'm the protozoa manager. Anyway, he described exactly what algae are.
They're eukaryotic organisms. They're basically kind of photosynthetic. They can be tiny wee cells that, you know, support life on Earth, really.
So little plants?
Essentially, aye.
So why is the Institute here so obsessed with algae? Because obsessed is the wrong word. But you've been involved in algae, not you personally, for a long time.
Yeah, we can trace our roots back for a long time. You know, the sea is full of kind of mystery and intrigue, and these organisms are kind of the key, the fundamental key to everything. You know, they've got so much potential that can be unlocked, really.
So these are building blocks of the whole food chain?
The whole food chain and the kind of future security of water, food, energy, I believe, yeah.
So why did folks start collecting them and researching them? Because you've got 200 years of records here.
That's a good question. Well, why do any kind of science? It's kind of learning and kind of exploring and finding out more about life, and it's kind of unlocking the kind of mysteries there.
Yeah, but algae are the great mystery, the great unknown, because I don't know. Presumably there's hundreds, thousands of different species?
Yeah, hundreds of thousands. In CCP, the Culture Collection of Algae and Protozoa, we've got just under 3,000 that we maintain. However, that's just a small fraction of what's out there.
So is this, I'm going to say, just a library with a view to needing different species in the future? Or is this actively researching these different species? Because that must be a challenge in itself.
It's quite a good analogy put there, a library. Whenever I kind of introduce CCP to people, I often describe it as a botanical gardens, but for wee microscopic aquatic plants. But yeah, we are a service provider, so we can make our strains available to anybody throughout the world. Also, we do research into evolutionary history, biotechnology, all sorts of things. So we're much more than just a library.
But a library, you can just chuck the books in there. You've got to keep this stuff alive, or can you freeze it?
We've got a team of 7 or 8 technicians and a few scientists which kind of lead that, and they are in the labs every day and have been for decades, kind of maintaining these serially cultures. But we've also got a cryopreservation facility, so approximately half of our strains are kind of long-term stored that way.
So what kind of research are folk doing around the world that they come to you? It must be quite difficult. Do they want a specific algae, or they want an algae that fits a particular remit for their research and you bail them out on that?
Yeah, so we get lots of orders in every day, commonly for aquaculture, so use in feeds or foodstuff. We get asked for strains that can be used for ecotoxicology studies, so seeing how harmful chemicals can be. We get strains that people can do genetic work on to try and find out the evolutionary history, through to things more kind of modern-day applications in biotech, so pharmaceuticals, cosmetics, nutraceuticals, all sorts of kind of high-value applications too.
Why do folk not know about this? I mean, it seems like that kind of research is going on under the wire, and the importance of algae to that.
I think people do know about it, or it's becoming increasingly to the light. I think the challenge is that there's so many different algae out there, trying to get funding, trying to make it applicable, all the kind of legislation and stuff that goes involved. There's many, many barriers that are kind of preventing world-scale algal cultivation, particularly in Europe, I would say.
Is that because it's dangerous, or just people aren't sure about wanting to invest in it?
I wouldn't say it's dangerous. I would say it's still like a modern application, I would say, so it's still kind of finding its early feet.
Is there potential for it to become a much bigger industry?
I think it's certainly growing. There are a few front runners throughout the world that are kind of specialising in certain products. So pigments, carotenoids are kind of investigated quite a lot.
What's a carotenoid?
It's a type of photosynthetic pigment. You typically find it in fruit and vegetables, so it gives carrots an orange colour. So it's these things. And they've got antioxidant properties, which can be really great for stimulating kind of health. So particularly kind of age-related diseases or eye-related diseases, it can be curative for that.
Is there a future for algae out there that you're just not aware of yet?
I think so. So CCAP, we're actively involved in this project called the Darwin Tree of Life, and that's aiming to try and get the full genome from basically all organisms, all eukaryotic organisms in the UK and Ireland, well, internationally as well, and that's basically whole genome sequences for basically every organism out there. And just the kind of knowledge that will come from that will be massive in every sort of application for the next 200-300 years.
Why? What's so special about the genome?
It's key to basically life, the tree of life, understanding our past and our future going forward.
A lot of what we're looking at, a lot of the trees we're standing under, perhaps had their origins in algae.
Yeah, for sure. They're kind of one of the key steps from there, from moving into producing oxygen. So they were right up there with kind of...
So we've got a lot to thank them for.
We do, and we still do. The air that we breathe, every breath, most of it comes from algae in origin.
Dr. Michael Ross, manager of the Culture Collection of Algae and Protozoa, and we'll hear more from the Scottish Association for Marine Science later in the programme as Ewan has a shifty at some seaweed.
I'd kind of put you in your place, you know, the air that you breathe comes from algae.
Every step you take, every move you make, I'll be watching you.
Yeah, you know, I'm anti-filling my boat to keep the algae up.
You didn't mention that, presumably.
No, I was thinking about it, though. Actually, this is the building blocks of life that I'm tinkering with.
Yes, yes, and not for the first time, presumably.
Yeah, with a lovely email from Sue and Steve in Strathdon saying, "Morning, boys."
Morning.
Looking forward to the programme so much, we're up half an hour early.
Wow.
Well, hats off to you. Perhaps you can answer a question at the Rose this week. Now, the Peasies and the Curlews are back partying night and day. We're wondering when the Swallows will arrive this year, which leads on to the question of when do they pack their bags and leave Africa? We thought you would know. Well, of course we do know. 6,000 miles, probably the ones coming from South Africa. They start getting their gear together about the end of February, the start of March. Takes 6 weeks. So they're on their way, and they should be here kind of mid-April-ish, something like that.
Yours, for some reason, bearing in mind you're further north than I am, tend to arrive 2 days before mine, which I don't entirely understand.
I think they go in some kind of loop. They come here for a couple of days, and then I think they head off to Shetland, so then you get the second wave. But it's such, you know, it's on a day like today, clear blue sky, and suddenly at the back of your head you hear that sound that you haven't heard since last summer. And it's just, you know, it's the real announcement of summer or spring, and it's just a glorious sound.
Because it was such a beautiful day yesterday, I was watching the pink-footed geese, and they did seem to be heading north. I'm just saying, I'm just putting it down the table, leaving it there, I don't know. Wednesday, 23rd of March, just last Wednesday, marked 2 years since the first UK lockdown was instigated. 2 years on, a COVID memorial for Scotland has been developed in Glasgow's Pollock Park.
Yeah, the idea came from poet and artist Alec Finlay, who himself suffers from long COVID.
Now, as well as the physical memorial at Riverside Grove, there's an audio element to it featuring memories from people who have lost loved ones during the COVID pandemic, based on the theme of I Remember. Now, before we hear from Alec, let's hear one of those readings by the actor Robert Carlyle.
I remember a riverside walk, the river still flowing, still doing what rivers do. I remember swimming in the peat black water of Whiteadder, with her close behind, long-limbed and casting ripples, our voices carrying down the river in the evening's dappled light. I can return to Whiteadder, but not to her. I remember standing in the dark in my garden at 3 a.m. during the first lockdown, and for the first time not hearing the constant traffic noise. Instead, being deafened by the sound of birdsong, it made me cry and filled me with hope.
The grove that we're standing in at the moment, I mean, again, these are mature trees. You're building an installation here as well. Explain this to me.
The two ideas I had very early on in the project were that I remember as a way of involving everyone. And the other idea I had very early on, I'm really a poet that makes art, and I just had the idea of the word support. And almost punning on that, we support one another by holding one another up, by hugging one another. We support one another with words. We support one another with money. We support one another with care, with affection. And I'd been thinking about tree supports, which are more prevalent in Japan, but it's very simple, like a crutch for a tree.
Literally a crutch for a branch going out.
And I realised that what was special about Pollock Country Park was that it wasn't really the right place for a garden. It's a classic Scottish woodland estate with many specimen trees, many beautiful trees, many old trees, many trees that are bent and have branches that bend down, and I thought that would work here. Just while we're here doing this, just over from us is my friend Hannah Laycock, who's a wonderful artist and photographer, and Connie, who was one of the people that set up the Bury Families, lost her beloved husband, and she is actually enacting a tree support with Hannah taking a photograph.
I'm doing the photography, the portraits for the commission. Portraits of people affected by COVID, but to be honest, everybody is affected.
I was too far away to hear what you were saying. And I was trying to make sense of it. The ladies seem to be physically supporting the tree, trying to produce attitudes which, had it been a much stronger prop, could have held the tree up. What were you saying to her?
I like to spend that time with people without my camera, without my equipment on me, like even just showing them examples of how, you know, they could potentially respond to it. So I just said to her, think about what you've been through and what you are going through and what you're fighting for. And so really listening to what to the individual, what they're saying, and picking up on those nuances to enable this kind of response photographically in a portrait. There was one, because we've done a few portrait sessions, well, throughout last year in 2021. And last year there was one particular individual who, she came along, which that in itself is, they're already open to the idea of responding to this idea of support and I remember. But she was finding it difficult to kind of understand the idea behind the poses. And through spending just a little bit of time with her and talking her through it and walking through the trees and giving her that space, it almost like turned around. There was a particular tree, it was more like a tree stump or like a really old tree that had kind of naturally fallen to the ground, but it was in sections. And she described that as being the epitome of what she had gone through, because she'd lost two family members, so she felt incredibly split and broken, like the tree.
I remember her standing by a fallen tree and saying, "That's me. I'm broken." I remember listening to the rain as if I'd never heard it before.
So my name's Connie McCready. I lost my fiancé, Jim, the 4th of May 2020. So I'd started up a support group in Scotland for all the bereaved to just... Because it was... I had to try and find support myself, you know, especially because we were in lockdown. So I started up the support group. And then my brother-in-law's boss wanted to get involved. So he had donated a bench in memory of Jim. And that's when the Herald got in touch with me to start... That's why I became involved in the memorial garden.
Tell me about Jim.
Jim was just amazing. He was full of life. I mean, we were only together for 6 years. In the 6 years that we had, we just fulfilled the life, because I'd lost my brother just after I met Jim, and he was 51 as well. And after that, my outlook in life had just changed, and I thought, We're living our life to the fullest, you know. And he used to laugh. He'd go, "Do we need to go to every single party that we're invited to? Do we need to go to every night out?" Yeah, we do, because we're invited for a reason. People want us there. Jim was a trucker, so he was very well known in the industry. I mean, very well liked. He was a pure gentleman. His nickname was Big Gorgeous, because
nobody's ever called me Big Gorgeous.
No, his truck was pristine. You like, yeah. His car, I mean, everything, he was just pristine. So they nicknamed him Big Gorgeous, and they used to say, "Do you drive with your slippers on and things like that?" Just because of how clean his truck was and his cab. So yeah, he took pride in his truck, he took pride in his car, and he took pride in himself, you know. So yeah, that's where he got the nickname Big Gorgeous.
I remember how much I love and miss you. Every single morning I wake without you, Debs.
Robert Carlyle, a reading from one of the I Remembers. This is our personal accounts collected for Scotland's COVID memorial in Pollock Park. If you'd like to hear more about the memorial, and it really came out of a campaign from the Herald newspaper, take a listen to the latest edition of the Scotland Outlaws podcast, available now on BBC Sounds.
Hey, the mystery bird is taking off. Quentin is having
a torrid morning.
Mare of a morning. But luckily, there are people out there who got it completely wrong. Steve Chadwick says, "Hi, chaps, is it acute?" No, it's not. Sandy Johnson in Langside says, "I'm afraid it's the one bird I detest." Well, you've said it's a magpie, but that's not what it is. And Malcolm in Orkies says, "Is it a hoodie crow? Lovely spring morning in Orkney." Yeah, fantastic.
I think we've broken Barry. Barry Sutherland, our South Yorkshire ornithological correspondent. I say you won't guess the mystery bird today. You two are being daft. It could be anything. To answer Ewan's question, the first sign of spring I look for is the house martin singing, but I'm not saying that's the bird, he says in brackets. Daniel, good morning. Bit frosty, but a wonderful day. I think it's a coot. Good guess, Daniel, but no. First sign of spring I look for is the aconite flower.
What's an aconite? Lovely. Is it not that wee yellow flower that kind of pops up just after the snowdrops? You get carpets on them.
Do you? Am I thinking... So I thought that was less a celandine. I thought I can... Is aconite not white? Well, we'll have a look into this.
We could stop sharing our ignorance of botany in the airways.
Very, very informed programme, this. Stuart Robertson from Pollock says it's today's mystery about the hooded crow, and Alison MacDonald thought it was also a coot. So it is causing a wee bit of confusion.
Yeah, anyway, have a wee blast. We will play a longer section.
Plenty, I would have thought.
Yeah, get in touch if you know what that is. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
Helen's been doing some research. Aconite's from the buttercup family and it's yellow. Except the Chinese ones and they're purple.
So that's 1-0 to Ewan.
It's not this programme is not a competition. I keep on saying this.
It's certainly another hour for you to catch up.
Indeed. What would you, now, here's a question for you. What would you consider the duration of a long walk? How long is a long walk?
5 days.
Yeah, that'd be about right to me. Go on to Phil Syme, our producer. His estimate would be around the 5 mile mark. However, after he met up with Julie Cribb from the Long Distance Walking Association earlier this week, his estimates went up a wee bit.
This walk we're on today, tell me a wee bit about this, and is this part of one of your established walks?
We have done this, yes. In fact, it's one of the ones that we've done from the station, because from Inverness Railway Station, which is next door to the bus station, we can come straight out along the canal, and then at the end of this, where the sea locks are, you can cross the main road, the Sibuley Road, and go up and over Craigpatrick. There's an Iron Age hill fort at the top of Craigpatrick, and it also joins further on from there onto the Great Glen Way. If you go through the Great Glen Way for a section, you can come out near the Burton Estates, near Abraken, and drop down through those estates on proper paths, accessible paths, onto the canal again, near Dock Garrick, where there's a nice cafe and restaurant, and then walk back along the canal back into town. So it's a really nice, about 16-mile circular route, all very accessible.
I love the idea of this accessibility because not everybody has got access to their own car. Mm-hmm. Was that an important factor in terms of making this inclusive?
The local groups are encouraged to put on more walks where you can access the beginning, certainly by public transport. So in our area, we're very lucky. We've got the Inverness as a hub, if you like, within a northbound train up to Thurso, where you can do sections of the John O'Groats Trail. We've got the Murray Coast that we can access by the Aberdeen train. There's the there's a few beautiful walks you can do from the West Highland train link from Glasgow through to Fort William. And of course then there's the bus service down to Great Glen. So there are quite a number of routes where we can start at one of the stations or bus stops, walk in a linear path and get on to get home from another bus stop or another railway station. Or we can just go out somewhere to Aviemore, say, and do a circular walk and then get the bus or the train home again.
So how do we define a long distance walk? Because your interpretation, I guarantee you, will be very different from mine.
Right, if you're doing a long distance trail, we have something like 1,500 of these on the database in the association's website. And they would normally be walks of over 20 miles, which have got certain characteristics. So they're accessible, they're safe, you're not going to get surprised by exposure, crags, barbed wire fences, things like that. And quite often, some of the paths have got associations, organisations or councils that look after them. So like the West Highland Way, like the Cotswold Way, they're officially recognised long-distance paths. So that would be one way of doing a long-distance walk. However, you can just walk anywhere, and we would say anything, say, over 15 miles is quite a long-distance walk. However, we do have challenge walks, and they can be anything from 15, 20 miles, usually up to, say, about 40 miles. But we do have 50-mile walks, which are qualifiers for our annual 100-mile event,
which we'll come on to we'll come on to very shortly. To most people, when you say walks of 30, 40, 50 miles and more, I was going to say they would run a mile. They probably would literally run a mile to get away from it. How would you sail a long distance walk?
There's a number of ways of doing that. Some of these walks are themed. So it could be, say, Castles Walk. We have a couple of walks locally that pass three or four castles. So you're not thinking about the distance, you're thinking about the topics and the viewpoints. Perhaps there's cafes on the way, so you would sell it as a day out.
So there's at no point it feels like a slog?
No, well, I don't feel that. And if people want to try it out, they can always try out either the slower-paced walk or a shorter walk, see how they get on. But one of the walks that we do not necessarily... Well, look, we have run it as a local social walk, is the Seven Locks Trail at South Lockness. But because that's 55 miles, we broke it into three different sections and ran it over three different months. So that's the other possibility, that instead of doing one huge trail, if you're not keen on that, break something down into sections. So you're sort of... You're not thinking of the end point all the time.
Yes.
I think that puts a lot of people off. Long distance walking is a mental activity. Well, people say it is a mental activity, but it's a mental activity as well as a physical activity. What you're training your mind to do is think in stages. You don't think of the end.
Yes.
Because that would put a lot of people off. You just think, next bit, and what am I going to see in the next bit? And who am I going to see in the next bit?
How much do you enjoy the kind of solitary side of walking? You know, that time just to yourself in the middle of, you know, a beautiful landscape somewhere?
I certainly do. I do enjoy solo walking. I just love being out exploring myself. I also enjoy just walking with perhaps one or two close walking buddies. But everybody's different. Everybody gets their enjoyment in a different way. And so there are some people that will only go out with, say, half a dozen or more people. And then during the day, you're talking about all different subjects and all different topics and, you know, exchanging views on things. It can be quite an interesting and informative day sometimes.
You've got an event coming up in May, which is not for the faint-hearted. Tell me a wee bit about that.
The 100-mile event is traditional. This will be the 50th running of that 100-mile event. A local group will volunteer to host it, and they volunteer 4 or 5 years in advance of the event, because it takes at least 3 years to put it on. The entrants are limited to 500 people for environmental reasons, because quite a lot of these hundreds go through national park land or privately owned land.
And is there a time scale involved for that 100 miles?
Yeah, we have to do it within 48 hours, and you are allowed up to a maximum of 2 hours stop at any checkpoint.
Well, I need to be truthful with you here, Julie. It's certainly not something I'll be signing up for, but I'll maybe see Mark and you.
Producer Phil Sime there, setting us a wee bit of a challenge.
If only we had time.
I know. Along with Julie Cribb there. 50 years of doing this, and they have to limit it to 500 people.
Bacchanites, I was just looking down the road. We've got carpets of them at the farm.
Ah, excellent.
Absolute carpets of the yellow ones.
We're getting asked if we can do some emails, because I've got a lovely one here from Araminta Dalmaya. She was talking about the fact that, you know, we played a couple of weeks ago that a clip from that podcast that we did, Mountain Men. And it was a programme that was put out in 1980. You then went and found the original producer of that and spoke to Ishbel, and that was interesting. But Araminta says, love last week's programme as always. What made me shed a large tear was to hear the voice of Jock Nimlin. I was a secretary at the National Trust for Scotland from 1969 to 1974. We shared a small office full of his pipe smoke, his wisdom, whether it be mountains, gemstones and a million other things, his enthusiasm and dry humour. He was the most lovely man. And whenever we were out and about in Edinburgh, he would always insist on walking on the traffic side, thus protecting me. See, that's a gentleman. Such a little thing, but I remember it vividly. I was in charge of sorting out all the hundreds of applications for the St Kilda work parties, which came in year, and of which Jock was a major part. Woe betide if I produced a dud. It was a total joy, as was his wife Jenny, says Araminta, or Minty. Minty, thanks very much for getting in contact with us. We did enjoy it, and it's still available up in the Scotland Outdoors podcast. Stay with us, because I'm going to be visiting the necropolis and Ewan's going back to school.
Yeah, we're going to be doing the mystery bird in a second, but we've got some fantastically wrong ones. John and Lewis and Rothy Norman said, "Mystery bird, thank you for the mystery clip. Next week's will no doubt be even shorter." Have you thought of silence?
Now, we have actually. We're going to, next week we're going to be doing it in mime.
Yeah. Tell me what we're thinking here. Craig Wilson in Cardonald says, "Great start to the weekend as usual, guys. Quietly confident this week that it is a moorhen." No, it's not. And Derek in the fourth takes it to another level again. "I'm going to have a guess at today's tricky mystery bird and combine it, of course, with the mystery tool. Is it a half-inch spanner?"
Very good. Very good.
Genius, Derek. Anyway, have a listen to the mystery bird. Now that is pretty easy. Quentin's getting he's earning his corn this morning.
I'm going to run through some wrong answers while we're at it. I mean, Rab thought it was a male pheasant. Patrick thought it was a moorhen. Air thought it in air. Shirley thought it might be a jay. Ken in Norfolk, house of the rising sun animals. Nah, you've got me. Kath from Falkirk thinks it's a coot. And Scott from Bothwell says, "Don't usually do this. Is it a moorhen?"
So disappointed, you know, first time having a go at it and you got it wrong.
Loch Leven is one of the most significant wetland sites in the UK. It's hugely, hugely popular. A year after the bird hide on the shores of the loch was destroyed by fire, construction's begun on a replacement. Now, I went to see how work was progressing in the company of Nature Scott Reserve Manager Neil Mitchell.
It's the new Phoenix hide rising from the ashes. The original hide was burnt down, February last year, so it's been just over a month now, local use unfortunately, but you know, from the ashes I think we're going to see something amazing, and it's really brought the community together. I think that's been one of the best things that we've found with this, is that everybody has wanted to help see this back up and running again.
Basically what you've got at the moment is four walls. It's nice at the moment. I like timber, I like any form of timber. You can smell the fresh cut timber of this, and it's kind of cantilevered over the water. It's a nice design.
It's a lovely design, and I mean, it did win awards at that. You know, the front just leans slightly out. I always think it looks a wee bit like the prow of a ship or something like that. It's a really lovely structure, and it looks brilliant, and it works really well. You know, it frames the view perfectly when you're in there.
Are we going to get an Enbys Road if we actually went into that?
I think if you feel like balancing your way over, we'll
be
all right.
Yeah, let's give it a go. Give it a go. How are we doing, gents? Not bad.
Oh, we've been teasing him, saying he's going to be on the radio. And he's hung it up, hasn't he?
If in doubt, hide. Yeah, quite. It frames the view absolutely beautifully over Loch Leven.
It does, doesn't it? I mean, it's just, we've got a lovely ripple. You've got the Scots pines there in front of the Sleeping Giant, as it's known locally. We've just had geese flying overhead there, pink-footed geese, and it just, you know, it's a lovely, lovely view.
I was laughing to myself because they passed me, or they actually flew over me in the car just as I turned the corner. I thought, isn't that flipping typical? You know, that would have been lovely just to sort of pass just over the top, because you could hear them even inside the car.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, that's one of the sounds the folk of Kinross are used to, you know, hearing the sound of the pink-footed geese going overhead. And I think that's, you know, they all appreciate having such an important wildlife site on their doorstep. But it's unusual because you've got the sound of the motorway in the background you know, but yet we've still got this, you know, throng of wildlife here.
How is this all being funded?
So it was a crowdfund, actually. Mm-hmm. So My Park Scotland, we did a crowdfunding for it, and everybody wanted to contribute. And it actually came out of the local community wanting to raise the money. We didn't ask. They actually said, we want to help raise money for that. And that was the amazing thing about this was, as soon as it happened, that weekend, I remember it vividly, so much in the press about it and so many people saying, we want to help rebuild it, raise money. There were people offering to build it themselves. And I mean, you can see the kind of structure that it is now.
It's complex.
Not easy to build, but there were people who were wanting to just help and get hammer and nails out and rebuild the thing as soon as they could.
See, this is all, it's very positive and feel good, and it's going to be a beautiful building when it's finished. How do you stop it happening again?
Well, it has now been fireproofed, so this one is now flame resistant. It's been treated with a special treatment to make it fireproof, and we've got an upgraded security camera over it as well. Yeah. They've literally just been doing that today, so we're being videoed right now. So
Hello, Mum. Hello, Dad.
Yeah. So you know, hopefully that will prevent it. But I think the main thing is, I think that you know the local community, I think, will help protect and look
after. Yeah, they're
after
kind of
it.
Invested in it much more so.
Absolutely, and yeah. I mean, I have to say thank you to the local community for the amount of fundraising that they did. So many charities and businesses as well, you know, and I think that's one of the things is that everyone appreciates what an attraction Loch Leven is. We consider it as Nature Scott as something, you know, it's one of our mechanisms for connecting people and nature, but actually everybody benefits from that. You know, the local businesses have done really well, but they helped fundraise. So there was a pizza place that did a raffle to raise funds. Local brewery did a special beer. The Cashmere Mill, Todd and Duncan behind us, they've been so good in giving us access for getting all this work done. It's just been like, you know, and I mean, the Beaver Scouts and everybody else has just all mucked in to help. And that, you know, that was just, in, you know, kind of middle of COVID and, you know, it was just really nice the way everyone came together over that.
Genuinely heartwarming. Well, let's pretend this thing's finished and roofed and we're looking out over the moment. What could we see out there potentially at this time of year?
This time of year, lots and lots of tufted ducks. So they're starting to pair up. Golden Eye too. The tufted duck will be nesting out on one of the islands in the middle of the loch. One of the reasons that it's so important and designated internationally. So they'll be there. Mute swans, there's often mute swans. And I think a story, one of the best things that I ever saw here, when my eldest was just still in a pram and we walked down here and we just pulled up pram here, just looking out as you are now, baby was screaming away in the pram and an otter just came along, looked at us like, what's that racket? And then just swam away. And I mean, that'll live with me forever, but I'm sure other people have memories like that. Kingfishers, great high to see kingfishers from this, you know, just perching in the willows off to the side, or that flash of blue as it goes past. It's a great spot.
One of the great annual identifiers for me is when the geese arrive and when the geese go away again. But I've always got mixed feelings when the geese go. There's a sadness to it.
There is. But then you think, you know, that's when you start looking for the sand martins, hearing the chiff-chaffs that we were hearing as we were walking down. You know, and ospreys, I mean, again, you know, they'll be arriving very soon. If I think they're already further north already. But all of these things, you know. So it's like, it's a change. It's not the end, it's just a change, you know. But, yeah, those things, part of the calendar of a nature reserve like this.
Neil Mitchell, Reserve Manager for Nature Scott at Loch Leven there. And that hide's going to be beautiful when it comes in. We've got some comments here. Richard and Mandy in Exeter saying, favourite sights of spring must include multicoloured tulips and the fantastic sight of magnolia trees in blossom. I said they're down in Exeter. Alistair Catorfin says, spring. My botany lecturer at St Andrews in the 1970s called the first flowering of gorse the botanical definition of spring. I only discovered a couple of years ago you can make decent herbal tea from the flowers. And Tobias Gould in Leicestershire says, spring is here when you can graze on hawthorn buds as your dog sniffs the verge. They used to call hawthorn the bread and butter tree. It's interesting because, you know, obviously spring means different things to different people. Joining us now to talk about why spring is such an important season for nature and wildlife is Jim Crumley, author of The Nature of Spring. Hi, Jim.
Oh, Mark, how you doing?
Not bad at all. You know, what's the flag for you that spring has actually arrived?
Well, I was intrigued by that reference to gorse. There's a hill not very far from here which has just gone yellow in the last, well, the last week. It has just advanced tremendously in this lovely weather. And I go out there to watch the peregrines. So the combination for me right now is watching peregrines through the glasses doing their display flights, which is never less than spectacular. And behind them in the glasses is this huge blurring hillside of bright, bright yellow. So that's pretty amazing.
Jim, we've talked to you in the past, and you spend a lot of time just sitting, watching and observing. Now, Alison Hepburn got in touch and she said, great programme this morning, can you answer a question? Several times recently, in the middle of the day, we've heard the distinct call of an owl in our local woodland. It's been met by scepticism, fellow bird watchers. Is it common? Any thoughts on what kind of bird it might, which kind of owl it might be?
It sounds like tawny owl. Obviously, they're much more vocal at dusk and during the dark hours, but they will call at pretty well any time of the day. I think possibly it happens more around this time. Also, if they get disturbed when they're roosting, I think that can induce it as well. But it's almost certainly a tawny, yeah.
You know, we're waxing lyrical about spring, you know, just soaking it up, you know, how fantastic it is, you know, what a wonderful season. We've been a bit unfair on winter.
I wouldn't say that. I mean, the book that I did about spring was one of a series of four, which began with autumn. And really, as far as winter's concerned, there is basically there's one season, and each one has a vital role to play in the whole ecology of the wild year, really. So spring is not really anything other than the continuation of what's been going on during winter and bringing that time to fruition. I wrote in the very first book, The Nature of Autumn, that the last day of autumn is the first day of next spring. And although for a lot of people, wildlife is much quieter and much more elusive during the winter, an awful lot is going on, particularly under the ground, for example, which results eventually in all the wonderful things that we do see come into life in spring. Every season is absolutely essential to what's gone before and what comes next.
I couldn't agree with that more, but do you not feel that spring, it makes us feel different? I don't know whether it's just that wall of bird noise or whether you start getting the scents, you know, the wild garlic, that kind of thing, or the hawthorn blossom. There's a promise there, an excitement, an energy that's difficult to determine in other seasons.
I think the re-emergence of light has a lot to do with that, Mark. One of the things that I take great pleasure from is the fact that it starts to make it easier to see the things that like to be more elusive, that like the dark, that have to come out in the later evenings and the earlier mornings. It starts to get easier to watch something like beavers, for example. Badger watching gets a lot easier in the spring. The spreading of the light certainly does make wildlife more accessible, I think, for anybody who's interested in going out and looking at it.
I suppose the big trigger for spring that's officially arrived are the swallows. Gus Bowman's been in touch. Morning, boys. Listening to your programme in southern Spain, the first couple of weeks we were down here, there was an abundance of swallows. But last week, they've disappeared. Maybe they heard of the good weather in Scotland and they're en route. Do you get that belt when the swallows arrive, or is that a bit passé?
I get that belt from all kinds of things, must admit. I mean, my first sound is always my first migrant bird here in Stirling is always chiff-chaff. And it's not one of the great noises in nature. You know, nobody ever wrote a poem about a chiff-chaff.
Oh, we will. You
know. Next week, guys, OK? It's the same tree at the end of the street, you know, and it's almost always the first thing. And I get a kick out of that. I mean, the whole migration thing absolutely blows my mind, and I just think of that wee bird. It's about 3 inches long or something, and it's sitting at the end of the street, and what it's done to get here, you know. And there's all these kind of triggers as well, and I think the cuckoo's got to be one of the great noises, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, I couldn't agree more. Jim, it's always a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thanks, Mark. Enjoyed it.
Right, that was good fun. And just to remind you, Jim's book's called The Nature of Spring. I mean, that whole series, you know, looking at the four different seasons, well worth a read. Stay tuned, because we're going to be joined by Dr. Kate Pickering later, who's going to be talking about why spring is such an important season for us as humans. Also, animals, obviously. Back to the Scottish Association for Marine Science near Oban now. SAMHS are just launching a new project, a Seaweed Academy, which aims to take would-be seaweed entrepreneurs by the hand to help them launch businesses along the coastline. Rhianna Rees is in charge of the new academy.
We're looking at the pontoon. So that's SAMHS pontoon there, and this is Dunstaffnage Marina Base.
And it's hiving here at the moment. There's boats going in, there's boats coming out, there's loads of work going on. This is a successful wee bay just outside Oban. But it's not reflected all the way up and down our coast. There's a lot of communities would give their eye teeth for a scene like this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's stunning. The water's really calm in this area. We've got a really good space to really have that hive of operation.
Now, looking down on the beach, we've got some, oh, I don't know what kind of seaweed that is, but seaweed has been an integral part of the Western Isles for decades, whether it's the lazy beds or the industry at the south of Harris. What is it about seaweed that's so exciting?
Well, I think there's this storyline that's happened. You know, we used to be so integrated, as you say, with the seaweed, especially in the Outer Hebrides, in the kelp boom of the 1800s, we had up to 100,000 people employed in the seaweed industry. And that died out, and now it's regenerating and reinvigorating itself as this kind of super crop that we can use for so many different things.
Well, what can you use it for? Because it's taken off the Far East as the fastest growing market, as far as I understand.
Yeah, and it's used really well for food, as you can see there. But the difference is, with Scottish seaweed, you're not going to use it for the same thing. You're not making it into sushi. You're going to use it for as a sea vegetable or as some kind of nutritional supplement. But you can also use it for potash. We've used it in the past for potash to make soap, to make bleaching, all sorts of things like that. It's for animal fodder. You can use it as a fertiliser, biofuel, all sorts of different aspects.
Now, I'm a late convert to using seaweed as a vegetable, but, you know, I'm there now. But you're talking about it as a fertiliser. You're talking about it for all kinds of things. That sounds like you need seaweed on a massive scale.
Absolutely you do. And, you know, you can grow it on a massive scale around here. We've got this really cool, nutrient-rich water that's perfect for seaweed.
Now, it has been controversial in the past, people proposing to rake the seabed up and pull up the kelp beds, and that was knocked back. But people got really angry about it.
They did, and it's easy to see. In Norway, they use it on scale, this mechanical harvesting, and it is like a lawnmower running along the seabed. Now, we've looked at research into how long it takes to regenerate, and it takes approximately 8 to 12 years to regenerate. So they say if you go by sections, it'd be fine, but it depends on which way you look at it.
But you've got a better solution.
We've got a better solution, yeah. So with the waters here, if you take your lines out and put ropes in the water, then you can cultivate seaweed on a mass scale out to sea in a way that brings biodiversity back to the area.
Kind of like a mussel rope.
Yeah, absolutely. You can even integrate it with other species like oysters, mussels, and really create a very, very dynamic environment.
OK, you've got the fact that you can do it. You're really keen to encourage this. You're launching a thing called the Seaweed Academy, which is an absolute genius of a name. But what does it involve?
Basically, we're really training people from beginning to end, so they get to know a little bit about the pre-licensing process, about how to cultivate, about the optimization in those processes, along to the real integrated aspects of research, so people get to know about biosecurity, about disease management and things like that. So we're really broadening the scope of knowledge.
So is this taking people by the hand from knowing nothing to actually having an established seaweed farm?
Absolutely. And as more people are coming out, as communities want to build this, as we're trying to see this economic growth in the area, then we're really offering people the tools and the knowledge to make that a possibility.
Could it be one crofter on his own?
It could be anyone. People who just want to improve their processes. We've got fish farmers who want to expand their knowledge. Or people who, yeah, want to just start something up on their own and have something in their back garden.
But would there be any negative aspects to farming or cultivating seaweed?
Well, so the only thing really that I've picked up on is the plastic pollution. That's quite a common thing now, especially in fish farming. And seaweed farming does have a lot of plastics in it. There are solutions that are being worked on, biodegradable ropes, things like that. At the moment, we don't have anything solid, but because it's an industry that is looking at the environmental and ecological contact, we are finding, hopefully, solutions to those problems.
What's the potential? I mean, it's quite exciting.
We've got really good research that shows that for bioremediation, so the spikes in nitrogen outputs from the use of fertilisers, from these fish farms, seaweed is a really good solution to absorb all of those nutrients out of the water and redistribute them in the same way that we're looking at carbon as well.
And would this work on just almost any community up the West Coast, or is it anywhere in Scotland?
Pretty much anywhere in Scotland. We know that the West Coast especially is very, very good for growth. You've got lots and lots of farms propping up, especially around the Argyll and Bute area, because you've got that calm water. Because if you do have storm events, you know, there are pockets that have better response rates, whereas the East Coast has a lot less research.
Rhianna Rees, Seaweed Academy Coordinator.
think it's just a great idea, taking folk by the hand who know nothing and helping them establish a business. These events, the Seaweed Academy's been launched on the 26th of April and the Algae event's on the 27th. If you go to Sam's website and Staffanage, all the details are there, but brilliant idea.
I love that idea of having one single rope coming up and having oysters on it, potentially mussels on it, and seaweed. I mean, it's basically a meal and a rope.
And yeah, it's but fresh you can get. Yeah, you could have one rope per household. Yeah, there's loads of great ideas. See, I was driving back along the Lochside yesterday. I suddenly saw this thing and managed to swerve to avoid it. It was a toad crossing the road.
Oh, right.
I do hope it made it. But James has been in touch from East Edinburgh. Morning. On my walk yesterday, I had a special joy as I met a very nice ranger helping toads coming out of hibernation to reach Dunstapy Loch. Some of them struggling with the kerb. Human harms can harm the amphibians, so I messed mine up in the mud first. But can you tell us the best way to handle the many amphibians in Scotland to reach water? Hey, a bucket's the idea, just a wee bucket. Mm-hmm. Put it in front of the toad and just encourage it very, very gently into it. Mm-hmm. I think the ranger service in the park in Holyrood have a big event every year where they help the toads and the frogs to the water.
I saw somebody the other day post something where basically they said that their mother had actually stopped traffic. Stopped the car, stopped traffic, had got out to help this hedgehog across the road, only to discover that somebody had dropped their hairbrush. So when she came up close to it, she thought, she basically just blagged the whole thing, pretended it was a hedgehog and carefully put it into the grass. Well, you're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElwraith. If you miss any of this, there are a few ways of listening again.
Yeah, and catch up whenever you want. BBC Sounds is the place to go.
Or download the Scotland Outdoors podcast, available from the aforementioned BBC Sounds. Tell us where you listen to the stuff. You can email us your stories at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, which is what, pardon me, Lou Jacobs did. He said, "Greetings from Baltimore, Maryland, USA, where I listen to your wonderful Scotland Outdoors podcast from my wood-turning workshop garage. My wife, Eric, and I are retired and have scheduled three times and postponed twice, thanks to COVID-19, our much-anticipated walk on the West Highland Way."
He's now rescheduled for late April to May, and we're guardedly optimistic that this time it will happen. Every additional episode of your programme makes Scotland both more familiar and us more anxious to be there in person rather than virtually. Thanks for these glimpses of your bonny home. That's Lou Jacobs. The mystery bird guesses have been flooding. You've got a whole pile of correct ones.
I do. Wrong ones. Sandy May near Blairgowrie says, "Good morning to the team. What a difference the return of the daylight makes. It lifts the mood, sorts out the sleeping patterns, and enables seeing things without the use of torches or electric lights. And now jackets are worn from warmth and not as a sooky blanket." Says, "Mystery bird, is it a moorhen?" Nope. Carl from Stonehaven says, "Coot. Same to you." There's a mischievously entitled forestry company from Inverness and Stirling saying, "Good morning, lads. The bird noise is a crow." We're not reading that out. And it's not the right answer. Graham from Inverkip says, "Is it a rook?" Stuart Taylor says, "I'm going birding this morning at my pal Martin's bird hide at a secret location near Elgin. Is today's mystery bird a rook?" And Andy Ross and Bewley thinks it's also a coot.
Have a wee listen to this. See if you know what it is.
Was that it? It was marginally longer, but only because we included another bird.
We're back to the economy version.
This is the year of stories, and Radio Scotland's running this series, 100 Years of Scottish Stories, and there's some beautiful stuff coming in. You know, basically we're asking people to say, you know, what's a story you would like passed on from your family to another generation? This one is a story from the Italian-Scottish community in Glasgow.
100 Years of Scottish Stories on BBC Radio Scotland.
My name's Kevin Feeney. I was brought up in the East End of Glasgow. I would like the next generation of my family to know about my Italian great-grandparents, Giovanni and Maria Coia, and they came to Glasgow just before 1900. They left a wee village called Filignano, that's in Province Isernia, near Naples, and they walked all the way from Italy, up through Paris and France, across to London, then eventually up to Glasgow. And en route up, they bought this thing called a hurdy-gurdy. This is basically like a musical instrument. It's a barrel organ, and it's fitted on a wheelbarrow type of thing, and they carted it up. And all Giovanni had to do was turn the crank handle, and Maria danced to the tunes as they walked and worked to Parkhead in Glasgow. And this is where they settled and raised a family of nine. The firstborn in the family was called Giacomo, Antonio Coya, really known as Jack Coya. He was the baby that was put in the basket on top of the barrel organ as they travelled north. And he turned out to be quite a fairly famous architect and became part of a firm called Gillespie, Kidd and Coya. And he designed many churches around Scotland, including St Bride's in East Kilbride and St Peter's Seminary in Cardross. My grandfather was a second born, and he told the famous story of a cycle from Glasgow to John O'Groats in the 1930s. With rudimentary bikes, they had numerous punctures, and just on the final legs of the journey, they filled the tyres with newspapers because they had no more puncture repair kits. And on the way back, they got like a cattle train back down to Glasgow, and they were in amongst the cattle. Great-grandfather Giovanni died in the 1950s, but the whole family were there until the 50s and 60s. And they, from a very, very humble beginnings, they all became part of the fabric in Parkhead, where they had cafes and hairdressers. And my grandfather, he had a cafe and chip shops and newsagents in and around that time. So it was these type of stories that I want the family to know about.
100 years of Scottish stories. Share your story. Head to bbc.co.uk/Radio Scotland.
Kevin Feeney there talking about his Italian Scottish heritage. That's a lovely idea, walking all the way up from Naples to Glasgow with a hurdy-gurdy.
Yeah, I just love the bit of stuff in the tyres full of newspaper to keep them going. I would never have thought of that. Top tip if you're out cycling today.
I've heard of that being done with rags in bicycle wheels. You know, basically just stuff it full of rags because they couldn't get puncture repair kits. If you'd like to tell us the one story you'd pass down to the next generation of your family, visit us online at bbc.co.uk/Radio Scotland and look for 100 years of Scottish stories.
We're getting quite a lot of stuff coming in, and it's taking a dangerous turn because they're asking us questions.
No, that's not going to work.
Really have to knock this on the head. Anyway, Callum's been in touch. Morning, chaps. Just looking out to the sea in a beautiful calm day in Bucky, mm-hmm. I noticed several flocks of seagulls, maybe 20 or more. Any idea what they would be feeding on at this time of year? I'm off for a walk from Portside to Cullen. I've done that. It's a fantastic walk. Brilliant coastal walk with ice cream reward at the end, and that's Callum. Well, you do get kind of balls of sand eels and all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. They get really concentrated on the surface, especially if there's mackerel below driving them up, and mm-hmm. the birds come down. And they all flock like that. And that's quite often, if you see that, watch it carefully, because that tends to attract dolphin or occasional minke whale. They'll come to that bait ball. Mm-hmm. And it's really quite a spectacular sight, but a beautiful, beautiful day for it.
Too early in the year for whitebait?
I don't know.
See, that's me asking you a question. Why are we wasting my time asking you questions?
Absolutely.
Well, who would know?
If you do know, outofdoors at bbc.co.uk, are the whitebait in Scotland.
Since its opening in 1832, the Glasgow Necropolis has become one of the most visited cemeteries in the country. Now, that's part because of the architecture that can be seen in many of the headstones and memorials and buildings. But it's so popular that you can now book a tour. You can actually get somebody to lead you around and explain what everything is. I recently met up with Ruth Johnson from the Friends of Glasgow Necropolis for a wander around.
The merchant's house was an incredibly important part of why the necropolis is here in the first place. They bought this piece of land, the hill that you can see in front of you, in 1650. And they bought an awful lot of land in Glasgow, obviously preferably for commercial development, but nobody could work out what exactly to do with a hill covered in fir trees, which is basically what it was. And it was called Fir Park. And it stayed that way for nearly 200 years.
Tell me what this is we're approaching.
This is the Bridge of Sighs. We're walking along down Kirk Lane, obviously because you can see our magnificent cathedral from here, and what you have under your feet are setts, and part of the necropolis is a quarry. And this is a type of stone. It wasn't good stone that you could use for actually carving some of the stones in the graveyard, but it was actually, this has been used for a lot of the streets of Glasgow early on.
And the Bridge of Sighs, obviously that harks back to the bridge in Venice.
Well, it's got a connection in the sense that you're going from the land of the living. It's a feeling that you're crossing water from the land of the living to the land of the dead.
The term necropolis?
It's the city of the dead.
And would all funeral processions have come along this bridge?
Absolutely. Yes. Yes, indeed. Now, when the Merchant's House, or a member of the Merchant's House called John Strang, decided, or he actually went to Paris and saw Père Lachaise, opened in 1804, came back with an idea that this would be a fantastic place for the dead opposite our cathedral, because Père Lachaise was some distance out of the city centre of Paris. And he did what we'd call these days a feasibility study. and the logistics of how much it would cost for the planting. This is a listed site, and that includes the landscape. So it was a planned landscape, including the trees and the planting.
Okay.
There's architecture here from most of the most famous architects. You've got Charles Henry McIntosh, Creek Thompson, Charles Wilson, you name it, and architects have actually produced work here. And you couldn't just put anything up here. It had to be supervised, looked at, and approved by the house.
You can hear the fact that we're in a city, you know, because, I mean, there's construction work going on basically to the south of us at the moment. They're pile driving. You can hear them banging away. Can you show me, I mean, because there must be hundreds, thousands of tombs in here. Maybe pick three, something like that. Sort of pick three highlights, something that really catches your fancy.
Well, there's 50,000 people here, and there's 3,500 monuments.
Wow.
I'm trying to pick something of the one on top of the hill, which is the Monteith Mausoleum to Archibald Douglas Monteith. Secondly, Lord Kelvin. And thirdly, I thought I would show you the monuments to the nurses from the Glasgow Royal Infirmary.
We head up this way?
Yes, we are.
Just where I parked, across the road, there's a plaque on the wall, basically, because it's where they hung about a dozen Covenanters, you know, in the time of the Reformation, because they refused to accept that the king had any authority at all over the church. Religion was a hotly contested topic for many, many years, still is in Glasgow. And yet this is unusual in that it's not a denominational
churchyard. It's interdenominational. It is mainly Protestant, I would say. We've also got a Jewish enclosure here, which was the very earliest part, 1832, outbreaks of cholera, typhus fever. And there was a small Jewish community here, and they were badly affected by that. They negotiated with the Merchant's House to have a small enclosure. And so that's the very earliest part. So here we have William Thomson. 600 scientific papers were published in his lifetime. The Kelvin scale of temperature named after him. He put the cable across the Atlantic, but it made his fortune in a lot of ways because it was a very commercially astute thing to do, and other people came to him after that. So, and this was actually put up by the Philosophical Society in 2007, 100 years after his death.
You know, for a storyteller, cemeteries are just such rich places.
Absolutely. As I said, every stone has a story.
Aye.
And fascinating stories. A lot of them are sad, but a lot of them are really inspirational.
Yeah. I always find something quite relaxing about graveyards, and I don't know why. I like them.
It's really a peaceful place. Unlike the medieval graveyards where you were kind of threatened with hell if you didn't behave yourself. This was really, Scotland's first garden cemetery, and was supposed to inspire you with the stories, the architecture, the sculpture, the people's stories. This is one of the nurses' stones here that we've had restored. There were 16 nurses that are commemorated in three different stones. This is the oldest one. The other two are actually much closer to the Royal Infirmary. And these six women that are here, one was an older woman who was a domestic servant, but the rest are all in their 20s. And they all died of diseases, infectious diseases they caught while they were doing their work.
There's something rather timely about that at the moment, isn't it?
That's why we picked these three stones to be restored. Because of the COVID situation, it's our way of a tribute. This is our Archibald Douglas Monteith. It's not bright enough for you to see the strange, grotesque heads under the eaves too clearly today.
Are they based on anybody, do you know?
Well, we had a person came on my tour that actually described them as the Wa Palace, which are door guards. This is a man who is an officer in the East India Company, a man called Archibald Douglas Monteith. He was incredibly wealthy, and he paid £5,000 in 1842 to have this put up. And that's the equivalent of maybe nearly £1 million in today's money.
What is the architectural style? Because I mean, parts of it look Italianate, and then you know, you look at the arches down below and you think, no, it doesn't quite work.
Well, it's supposed to be based on a church in Cambridge, a Templar's church in Cambridge.
Ah, right, okay.
But we're not sure. As I say, it's got the decoration from his time, and it's really, really ornate on the outside and very plain inside.
I love to see the ageing in some of these things, and I know it's distressing for historians because, you know, there's lots of information. The backstory is disappearing, but it's there's something quite natural about it to my mind.
Yeah, we're actually recording and photographing every single stone, so there'll be nothing lost from now on, at least.
Yes.
And we're doing all the research into the burial registers, indexing our burial registers, and our guides, we've got 8 guides that take people round and tours all the time, just to get people to understand how important this cemetery is.
Fantastic building. It's just an incredible place.
That was Ruth Johnson there from the Friends of Glasgow Necropolis. The Mystery Bird has got all sorts of people coming in. We've got so far 5 pages of correct answers. Here are some of the wrong ones. Alex in Glasgow says, Mystery Bird beyond my 30-year-old brain this morning. Great show as always, calming the mind ahead of a big hockey match today. Cheers for all you do. Oh, no problem at all, Alex. Harriet Martin says, spring is birds nesting, frog spawn, the pond fish reappearing, and it's getting out in the light to garden. Today's Mystery Bird could be anything, but the crow outside replied to it. Ooh, that's interesting.
Well, yes. I was going to give a clue there, but I'm not going to give a clue because there's too many of you got it right.
Yeah. Sheila says it's a rook. It's not. Katie in Perth says, I think it's a pheasant, although I don't know which one. Stuart Wilson from Edinburgh, I love this. Just take a wild punt. Great show as always. Good to hear Robert Carlyle on those special readings. I've never entered the Mystery Bird before, and I thought I would enter this time as I don't have a clue. Is it my favourite bird, the Great Crested Grebe? No.
Wish it was.
Really wish it was, but it's not, unfortunately. George in Edinburgh, this is lovely. Says, we found a queen bumblebee in our grass yesterday, looking very tired, crawling for a long time. We smeared some honey on the grass beside it, and it seemed to eat. We feared it had got its feet stuck. We stayed with it for about 25 minutes in case a bird nabbed it, and to our astonishment, it suddenly shot off into the sky, apparently re-energised. Is this a likely analysis of events? Well, yes. It'll do us, George.
That's good for us. You can also put kind of sugary water or honey in water. Aye. Sometimes helps as well. Yeah. Just in the lid of it. Not too much, otherwise it'll drown. But if you can get a bottle top, a beer bottle top or something that kind of size, they might go for it. Alistair got in touch from Elgin, taking us to task. And I'm kind of with him on this.
Crack on.
Gorse is the first sign of spring. On our walks, I've photographed gorse in January, February and March. Hope to get a photo in every month of the year. You're right. I mean, you get gorse all year round. But you do get that flush now and that fantastic smell of coconut, and it makes great tea. Anyway, a wee while back, I spoke to Darren Woodhead, a watercolourist, graduate of the Royal College of Art in London, originally from West Yorkshire, now paints in East Lothian. And what's fascinating about Darren is he nothing daunts him. He takes the art to the outdoors and the outdoors to the art. I joined him painting in the rain.
It's the experience, but I'm also an artist. I think my way of expressing myself is through painting, is through making a mark, and especially the way I work is just in brush, no pre-drawing, on white paper, and it's a direct response to what you're seeing. But
you're kneeling down, and you know it's winter, it's damp, it's you know the rain's coming every now and again, the paper's soggy. I can see the attraction underneath the apple tree in midsummer, just dabbing away with a paintbrush, but you've got rain, you've got frost, you've got snow, and that's all going onto your paper, and then it's diffusing all the paint all over the place.
But and also that's an interesting thing. I mean, I know when I've been in India, it's been crystal blue skies, and I've painted there, and it's fine. But then day after day of blue skies, warm, it doesn't allow for me watercolour. I mean, watercolour is such a fragile medium, and it's and every little thing affects it. So the slight change in humidity, a wind, a frost coming in, it changes the way the paint behaves, and that's a huge interest to me.
And you're out there listening all the time, because I'm watching, you suddenly hear a blue tit or something, you're looking up, and then a couple of minutes later it's in your painting.
I love that being tuned into the environment, and in such a way that it's so easy to miss. I mean, I think, do we naturally see anymore? I don't know, but being outside and learning to listen, learning to see, and just actually giving that space of time to do that is something that, that we lack often in everyday life.
So does that register like a photograph in your brain? Because we were out earlier on today, you know, and the bird of prey comes screaming through after the grouse, and then suddenly it's on your bit of paper. Are you racking that away in the back of your brain and then bringing it onto the paint?
If I can recall it, I'll draw it. If I can't recall it, then I won't. But, I mean, I'm painting every day, so hopefully I'm sharp enough to get that when it happens and when it comes through. But I feel it. I need to be working every day just to keep sharp.
But you're not like me. You would be tempted to put in a golden eagle just because you can.
No. I mean, for me, are they diary pages? But the paintings that recall the day. Nothing takes more than a day. It's an event. It's a happening. It's a story of that day. And whatever I see goes in. Whatever I don't see doesn't go in. So
are you out every day, painting every day in the woods or up in the moors?
Yeah, I do. I mean, and I this thing about painting every day, it's a obsession almost, I suppose. But it's a drive as well. And if I'm not painting, I'm seeing paintings. I'm seeing colours, I'm seeing horizontals, I'm seeing verticals, I'm seeing compositions. And that's purely just part of being an artist, I suppose.
And you're making real, I mean, this is a difficult joy of painting on the radio, but there's no white in your palette. There's no black either.
No white, no black, and I don't carry greens. So, I mean, the white's the paper, the black I mix with colours, greens you mix with colours. And, yeah, I mean, watercolours, it is. It's so fragile and so delicate that... And it's a storyboard. I can read watercolours. You can tell the start point, you can tell the finish point, you can tell what's going on within it, what dried first, almost.
I have watched artists do that. There was a woman, Iona Leishman, you know, who did it, and she was painting beside a river, and it was bucketing rain. And I used to work in watercolour, and I thought, how on earth is this going to work? She kept on picking it up and sort of rotating it gently, just moving it from side to side, and letting, basically, the rain do some of the work.
Yeah, I had a go at it, and it really amazed me. It's a whole totally different technique, minimal amount of paint. And the fact, you know, he's got no, as he said, no black. He uses the white of the paper as the white.
Yeah.
And no green, you would have thought that was a nightmare in the countryside. Yeah. But just that almost instant, I mean, it was instant. The blue tit appeared, and it was do-do-do-do-do, and there it is. And he's a fantastic artist, and he's just one of the best in the country.
There used to be a gallery at the foot of the Campses, and it was run, and they had a coffee shop and what have you, and Melanie, who was one of the owners, looked at some of my art one time and went, get black out of it altogether. It's just, basically, it's just you do whatever you can to make black, but do not use black out of a tube in watercolours. And it was a useful lesson.
Yeah, my dad was a great artist, and he went mental whenever I pulled out a tube of black paint. He said, oh! The closest he would let me get was a wee dab of Payne's Grey now and again.
Aye. Yeah, well, see, that's subdued, gentlemanly tones. That's fine, absolutely fine. Mystery Bird this week has been hilarious. We've had lots and lots and lots of wrong answers, but we've also had lots and lots and lots of right answers. John got it right, Elspeth Hobson got it right, Alistair and Elgin got it right, but also added, can you please remember it's the early morning, all that technical information about algae from Dr. Ross first thing. Hard enough putting on the kettle and making the toast, for the love of goodness.
Richard, well, you tune into this programme to be intellectually challenged. That's our raison d'être.
No. We're the ones that are intellectually challenged. Richard and Mandy in Exeter got it correct. Ross and Tainot got it correct. He says, surprised this one hasn't come up before. Says, you know, he's been doing the Mystery Bird since it started at the beginning of lockdown. Maeve and Joan in Varuri, Richard Edwards in Ellen, Sandy from Dunglugas, Elspeth from Gillane, Callum from Balmermer near Arbroath. Says, I watch every year the drama of a pair who nest in a chimney in the cottage in front of me. Every year the crows try to raid it with a pair defending their family with everything they have. Great programme. Barry Sutherland. Came up with the right answer. A note from Quentin, the chap on the phones, he said this with strong conviction. Good on you, Barry, because the correct answer was a jackdaw.
The white bird with the all-seeing eye was nervous as she hopped onto the open window ledge. And rightly so, because she was here with a message. A message for a god. The son of Zeus, the king of the gods, the god of the sky and thunder and lightning. His offspring, the god Apollo, the god of music and sunlight, of healing and poetry, and the protection of the young. But like his father, he had a temper. Now, Apollo had a lover, Coronis. She was already pregnant with Apollo's son, who was to become the Greek god of medicine. But while she carried the child, she met a mortal man. They talked, they laughed, they drank the wine reserved for the gods, and in the evening they took to the woods, only to wake together with the dawn, and as the morning sun struck the pair, it found them entwined in the undergrowth. Above, on the branch of a walnut tree, the bird with the all-seeing eye cocked its head to one side and watched and thought. Now, the Kawoti is a gossip, the tabloid reporter of ancient Greece, and below her, deep in the forest, she had a scoop and a choice. Fly to the flocks of corvids with her hot scandal, or take it up a level for the big story. Risky, but with the potential to give her kudos, status, and become the queen of the tittle-tattle world of the forest. She chose the path of ambition. And here she was, on the ledge of one of the most complex gods of ancient Greece. Apollo gave her a glare as she fluttered into his cell. But the jackdaw is a fearless bird and returned his stare as only a chalk can. For like many of the crow family, they communicate, not with sound, not with movement, but by looking deep into the soul, into the eyes. Apollo looked. He looked into that all-knowing eye and felt the rage build and build and build. Coronis had stepped from the world of the gods into the shame of the bed of a mere mortal. He unleashed a terrible punishment. Coronis paid the ultimate price. Apollo performed a caesarean to save his son and condemned his lover to the skies to become the constellation Corvus. A small cluster of stars in the southern celestial hemisphere. Its name in Latin, the Crow, the bringer of bad news. And Apollo did turn to the bringer of bad news. In an instant, the door was turned from white to black as a punishment forevermore. The Caddo is an incredible bird. They pair for life, share food, and can read thoughts, whether daw or human. Now, earlier I mentioned that the college bird is desperate to be queen of the forest. And like European royal families through the ages, the easiest way to achieve status is to marry up. In the 1930s, the Austrian ornithologist Konrad Lorenz determined a strict social hierarchy within jackdaw groups called trains or clatterings. Unpaired females rank lowest in that hierarchy. They're the last to have access to food, the last to have access to shelter, and are liable to be pecked at by others without being permitted to retaliate. But when a female is selected by a high-ranking mate, especially the dominant male, she assumes the same rank as a partner and is accepted as such by all the others in the group, and she will impose her status by pecking. It's always good to marry a king, especially if you're a jackdaw.
And there we have it.
Yeah, I mean, it's not often you'll get a guided tour through the gods of ancient Greece, from Apollo to Zeus to marrying a king.
Indeed, indeed. You know, and I was in Newborough yesterday, and just across from the community hall, there is a large, what would it be, a beech tree probably, and there is a clattering of jackdaws in that.
Yeah. I was trying to find it in the night sky. I'm going to have to look a bit harder. It's in the...
it's in the southern hemisphere, isn't it?
Yes. Well, that's why I haven't seen it. That's what they meant, the southern part of our hemisphere. Oh. You're probably right.
I don't know for definite. I think it's in the southern hemisphere. But, you know, listen, there's going to be folk listening to this at the moment thinking, do these guys know anything? Anything at all?
Well, we know a snippet of something.
Yes.
We would have a snippet of everything.
Yeah.
And in depth of nothing.
And we're now getting to the age when we're thinking, I can vaguely remember something about this. But yeah, there is actually a family connection between me and jackdaws. Because my mother's...
You've both got beady eyes.
Indeed. No, well, we don't have silver eyes. My mother's maiden name was Kai, C-A-I-E, which I think originally was Dutch as a name, but it's an old Scots word for a jackdaw, a Kai. And it's one of those onomatopoeic words, I think. Just running through some of the correct answers.
Oh, good luck with that.
Indeed. Will says, beautiful morning in Gala Shields. Looking forward to today's rugby match against Highland this afternoon. Is the Mr. Bird a jackdaw? Yes, it is. Wendy from Montrose got it right, saying, common patrolling the St. Cyrus Cliffs all summer. Keith de Akemney got it right, says, used to have them nesting in our chimney pots before we fitted covers. This is a common theme because Ewan and Avril says, we have some nesting in one of our unused chimneys and clumping about our roof in tackety boots. Kathy Adesia says, sounds very much like the sound we hear in our chimney of a morning. And Anne in Coldingham says, I hear that sound every day when our local jackdaws fight over the bird feeders in our garden. And that's something, I don't know whether you get this problem in your family, but basically my wife doesn't like feeding what she calls the big birds. You know, the rooks, the jackdaws, the crows, the things like that. And as far as I'm concerned, they're hungry too. They deserve food. But she was saying, we're getting through one of these things, you know, one of these feeders every time. Ooh. But I got a protected feeder from the supermarket. She's got a wire cage on the outside and the nuts go in the inside, and it's taken them longer to get through it. Listen, don't forget the midweek podcast. It features David Spaven on a train journey. We've run out of time. Thanks for listening.